Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on proposed shift changes with the East Chicago Police Department, the 2020 presidential election could stall Indiana judgeships, Brandon Smith reports Indiana lawmakers will likely file legislation in the 2020 session over proposed rules at the Bureau of Motor Vehicles for Hoosiers to change the gender on their driver's license, and Chris Nolte has a conversation with the Executive Director of the Northwest Indiana Forum, Heather Ennis. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. East Chicago Police Chief Hector Rosario said a police staffing shift change expected to go into effect next month won't dilute manpower on the streets. The police department will move from a 4 days on, 2 days off work schedule to 5 days on, 2 days off. The change comes on the heels of a controversial planned shift in firefighter hours. The Times reports the Common Council voted Monday night for final passage of an ordinance rolling back work shift changes city firefighters oppose. The council vote would return the firefighters to their old work schedule of 24 hours on duty and 48 hours off. Mayor Anthony Copeland, who imposed an unpopular swing shift on the firefighters earlier this month, now has 10 days to veto the measure. If he does, the council would have to override the veto with a supermajority early next year. The plan changed in police scheduling was discussed at a recent meeting of the council's Public Safety Committee, which Rosario and Deputy Chief Jose Rivera were unable to attend. Rosario told the council on Monday night he wanted to dispel concerns about the shift reducing manpower on the streets. The change to 5 days on would mean all officers will have the same 2 days off all year. So only one group would have off on weekends, while the other two groups will have their days off fall on weekdays. Some council members expressed concern that not having any weekends off could make it harder for the city to retain officers and could lead to officer burnout. Officers with higher seniority are being given first dibs at having weekends free. Rosario said only officers fresh out of the police academy would start with no weekends off and that officers would be allowed to switch days off with each other if it is done within the same shift and pay period. He goes on to say the first year will be a trial run, and if it doesn't work out, options for the next year could include picking names at random for weekends off or rewarding officers with high productivity. The main reason for the shift change is to incorporate training on the day of the week that all officers would be on schedule. In early 2019, the East Chicago Police Department was put on notice by the Indiana Law Enforcement Academy that 20-plus officers didn't have their mandated training. The police powers of those officers was going to be revoked. Chief Rosario said having a training day on Wednesday of each week can result in getting training done early in the year and not having to pay overtime later for training to be completed. The department currently has 87 sworn officers, while it is budgeted for 99 officers.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
NIPSCO has agreed to pay a $1 million fine to settle a federal complaint that it discriminated against some 1,500 female or black job applicants. NIPSCO reached a deal with federal officials after a U.S. Department of Labor investigation found the utility discriminated against qualified women or black applicants for meter reading or service representative positions during 2013 and 2014. The Times reports NIPSCO also agreed to give priority to hiring 27 of those applicants as jobs become available over the next 2 years.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
A Republican U.S. Senator
from Indiana is urging Congress to add two judges to one of the nation's most overworked federal courts. But the 2020 presidential race is setting up even more pronounced partisanship to the already party-driven process of judge appointments. The U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Indiana has the second highest caseload in the nation. The Indianapolis Star reports Senator Todd Young wants to tackle that issue now, but the legislation to add more judges hasn't progressed because the political parties in charge of the judgeship appointments could change posts next election.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Farmers will likely face a tough decision over the winter over the amount of corn or soybeans to plant this spring. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports the market could push Hoosier farmers closer to a 50-50 split between the two staple crops.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
It's unlikely the General Assembly will give counties more money in the 2020 session for new voting machines. More than half the machines in Indiana don't have a paper backup. Something election security experts insist is critical. The legislature appropriated enough money in the 2019 budget to provide backups to 10% of the machines that need them. Lawmakers do plan in the 2020 session to use excess surplus dollars on cash payments for some pre-approved projects like a swine barn at the State House Fairgrounds. But money for more voting machines doesn't make the list. Governor Eric Holcomb says that's because Secretary of State Connie Lawson. Has assured him Indiana's voting systems are secure.
The first minute that she comes to me and says, "We need to be doing more, and this is what the cost will be," I become a huge advocate.
State House fiscal leaders say something similar. No one's come to them to ask for voting machine money. Still, House Speaker Brian Bosma won't rule it out.
Don't know that it's been determined that it's not yet, we're most concerned about managing the surplus properly.
The 2020 session begins January 6th.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The number of homeless students enrolled in Hoosier schools nearly doubled between 2008 and 2018. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports the state's largest district says it doesn't seem like the problem is getting better.
According to state data, Indiana had more than 16,000 homeless students enrolled in schools last year. Fort Wayne Community Schools has the highest student enrollment overall and the second largest population of homeless students. Spokesperson Krista Stockman says the district offers meals and transportation to any homeless student enrolled in the district.
And when the state funding formula looks at kids, that's not something they necessarily take into consideration.
The state's school funding formula accounts for local poverty rates, but not homelessness specifically. Stockman says that makes food, funding, and clothing donations from community members essential to serving those students throughout the year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Family and Social Services Administration announced the federal approval of a Medicaid waiver that will pay for inpatient stays for Hoosiers diagnosed with serious mental illness. Medicaid law had prevented the use of funds for inpatient mental health treatment at facilities with more than 16 beds. The new waiver will help patients receive more appropriate and longer inpatient stays, which will aid in the stabilization and transition of patients back into the community. It is also expected to drive down costs associated with overuse of emergency departments for mental health problems. Vermont and the District of Columbia are the only other states or districts to receive a waiver. The waiver takes effect January 1st.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Some teachers across the state are upset that state funds are set to be taken away from five classes that teach skills like personal finance and child development. Instead, it will go to career-specific classes like advanced manufacturing. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports it highlights a change in the state's priorities around career and technical education programs.
All right, go ahead and listen up real fast.
Here at Pike High School in Indianapolis, nutrition teacher Cam Bontrager is guiding students through their last lab of the semester. The task? Making smoothies.
You have your dragon fruit, okay? You have your strawberries, raspberries, and I'll get the people that have the mixed berry smoothie, I'll get you your stuff.
The class is part of the Family and Consumer Sciences program. It has classes in nutrition, child development, and interpersonal relationships. And they teach skills an average adult uses daily. Things like using a measuring cup, how to write a resume, or avoid sexually transmitted diseases. But FCS Department Chair Amber McKinney says too many people have an antiquated idea of what she teaches. She says other teachers imagine her classes to be like their grandma's home ec class.
Sewing pillows, sewing flannel boxer shorts, things like that, making Rice Krispie treats and cookies. And that's so far from what we do.
In the past, these foundational classes got $150 per student from the state. But a proposal sent to the Indiana Board of Education earlier this month would officially remove that funding for five of those classes. And McKinney says even though schools could still offer the courses, the question is, how will they pay for it?
I mean, look around at our facility. Like, this is not a cheap, it's not just a classroom with desks. If the school's not getting funding for that, it would be tough for a school to carry on that program.
The change was first proposed to the governor's workforce cabinet in 2018 by a group of career and technical education leaders. They were tasked with figuring out how Indiana could use CTE programs to have more Hoosiers earning technical credentials.
Well, we were charged with, as an action team, to review our total CTE system.
That's Alan Taylor. He's a CTE director in Southern Indiana and was a member of that team. They found that over a quarter of all the students taking CTE classes were only taking those foundational skills classes. In their final report, they wrote that funding the foundational classes created a, quote, perverse incentive for schools to avoid offering more career-specific classes.
Though we have a record number of participating students, we want more of those students to complete a pathway in a very conscious manner so that they're earning stackable credentials and dual credits and maybe post-secondary certificates.
Taylor says when they wrote the recommendation, it wasn't intended to snub those foundational skills classes. It's just a matter of priorities. But he understands how teachers could be upset by the funding change.
And again, I know it's a matter of perspective, but funding wasn't cut. We actually, in Indiana, increased the funding to CTE. It was redistributed. And we do that every couple years.
Soon after, language was added into a whopping budget bill that passed in the General Assembly. It removed the category of foundational career and technical education courses from the funding list. So when it came time for the DWD to submit their funding plan to the State Board of Education, they omitted five of the six foundational classes. The other was recategorized. In light of all of this, some Pike High School students wonder if their school will cut those classes if they don't get incentive funds next year. Here's 16-year-old Maya Guzman and 15-year-old Ramaya Nelson.
Classes like this, it's not just like classes you take for fun. Like, as the class goes on, like, you start to realize, like, this class is, like, an important class, and, like, it actually helps you throughout life.
Like, it teaches you a lot of life skills that you should know.
On December 27th, the State Board of Education is holding a special meeting about the funding changes, even though, according to a spokesperson, Indiana law requires them to approve it before January 1st. Even if that happens, schools can still appeal the decision through the Department of Workforce Development. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Lotte with a conversation with Heather Ennis, Executive Director of the Northwest Indiana Forum.
Tell us more about how 2019 seems to have shaped up for the forum and certainly for all of the members of the organizations that help make up the forum.
Certainly. So it's been a very exciting year for Northwest Indiana. And this year, the forum teamed up with the Indiana Economic Development Corporation, and we did 24 outbound trips talking about Northwest Indiana with our local economic development organization partners, as well as the IEDC, NIPSCO, and others. We traveled all around the country and told the story of Northwest Indiana. We got an opportunity to meet with over 400 site selectors, companies, and brokers to tell the story, all around the country, as well as we made a trip to Canada as well. So Virginia, North Carolina, New York, Colorado, Seattle, Washington. So really traversed the map. So
I know one of the areas in particular that you focus on is, of course, not only stimulating business to bringing people that and organizations that maybe are not all that familiar with Northwest Indiana within Northwest Indiana becoming members of the community, so to speak, but also you talk too about expanding jobs. How does the forum fit into all of these different segments? And I guess maybe that's all part of this overall plan that has come out, and we've talked about before, about the program, which is called Ignite the Region.
Yeah, so Ignite the Region, our strategy for economic transformation is alive and well. So we kicked that off in 2018 and spent 2019 continuing that collaboration and working on implementation and transformation. There are about 123 initiatives on the Ignite the Region implementation matrix. We've got 112 of those that are currently in process, and 22% of them being completed. So it's pretty exciting. We're seeing things come not only get started, and the organizations around the region working hard together to get things done, but actually getting things done and moving things forward. We're really excited about the entrepreneurship and innovation team is working on an implementation of Impact Labs, which will be for not only for entrepreneurship, but intrapreneurship, as you were talking about, Chris, seeing the companies that are here grow. Mm-hmm. And so helping companies that are here be more innovative and figuring out how to remain relevant in their marketplace. So we're excited about that partnership. We're working with Center of Workforce Innovation on a 21st century talent region and really putting some numbers to the implementation matrix and what targets we're trying to hit. So it's been fun, a whirlwind of a year in 2019.
When you talk about some of the components that go into the Ignite the Region program, the multi-pronged approach, as I know that you all call it there at the forum, you talk about topics like infrastructure and placemaking. We've talked about some of the other major points about business development and entrepreneurship and talent in particular. That's where you're trying to get the Center for Workforce Innovations and be able to get them involved in bringing more jobs into the region, getting more people being able to be ready for those jobs. Where does infrastructure fit into the picture?
So obviously we have to have strong infrastructure in order for companies that are here to grow, as well as to be able to attract companies. So there's very exciting things happening around the infrastructure at the port in Burns Harbor. We're seeing exciting developments and prospects that are continuously looking at the Gary Chicago Airport and the other airports that we have in the region. The rail infrastructure is a critical asset to the industrial development that looks at our region, and that continues to grow here. So we try and keep a close eye on all of those things and make sure that we're aligning our resources to be best used for what we want our economic future to look like here in the region.
One of the things that gets brought up all the time, I'm sure, and you all cover it, and people, when you talk with folks outside Northwest Indiana, and if they're even remotely familiar with Northwest Indiana, about the great industrial legacy that we have, is the on the other side of that industrial legacy is the environmental problems that come with all the heavy industry that we have had in the region. We've shed many of them, but and of course a lot of it's changing because of the changes in the 21st century. But how does the forum fit in with trying to help revive some of these areas that used to be heavy industry into places that people can in turn use again with other types of business? And a lot of these, we've talked before about brownfields. How does this all fit into what's been done in 2019 and what you're hoping to do next year?
Yeah, so we were the recipient of an EPA grant this past year, along with our partners of NERPC and the Regional Development Authority. We jointly applied for funds from the EPA and have been awarded a grant to be able to help revitalize some of those properties. One of the largest problems for attracting investment to Northwest Indiana is that we don't have enough product ready. And so being able to redevelop those brownfields and remediate those properties to get them back on the tax rolls and get them cleaned up and better for the entire environment is a critical component for our success moving forward as a region.
What kind of input do you get from not only the businesses and the industries here in Northwest Indiana, but other organizations outside the region that maybe are interested in locating some type of business here, whether it's just a small outpost, so to speak, or a full-fledged factory? What kind of things do you hear from these people who want to maybe have a say in what the Northwest Indiana of the future is going to look like?
You know, it's so exciting. We spent some time in Seattle, as I said, at a tax preparedness conference, and different states got to give presentations to these tax incentive specialists that work with companies that are looking to locate in a certain area, or work directly for the company. You know, there are representatives there that are directly aligned with companies such as Honda or Lockheed Martin was there. So there were tax specialists, and as the states were talking, there was a site selector that was in the Michigan state presentation and kept referring to that it was a competition between Michigan and Indiana for this project, and the site selector kept referring to how competitive Indiana was for the project throughout the Michigan presentation. I felt a little bit badly for the Michigan folks, but it was really exciting to see that people are getting the story. People are understanding the opportunities for Indiana and how great our tax climate is and how wonderful our assets are. And then they continuously referred to Northwest Indiana and the infrastructure and what that means from a competitive standpoint for business. It turned out that Michigan ended up doing something extraordinary to close the deal, but it was kind of fun to listen to folks out from outside of the region during a presentation about another state talking about how awesome Indiana is. So the message is getting out there, and people are starting to realize that we've got great workers, great opportunity here in the region. As the heart of the Midwest, we really have an awful lot to offer, and we truly are the middle of everywhere. You know, our proximity to the East Coast is easy. The Great Lakes offer us great proximity to the world, and so we're really very fortunate where we're at.
I know you spent a lot of time in 2019 following through and fine-tuning the Ignite the Region initiative. What kind of goals does the Northwest Indiana Forum have for 2020?
So 2020 is going to be another exciting year. As I said, we did 24 trips this year going out and telling the story. We've got 42 active projects. We'd like that number for 2020 to be 50 active projects that we tackle for 2020. Again, we'll probably have somewhere in the 20 to 25 outbound trips where we work with partners to go out and tell the story of the region. We hosted 19 networking events here in the region. We'd like to do the same in 2020. I think that, you know, we're really seeing things come to fruition from the Ignite the Region plan, and really being able to put some more dollars towards those projects and to be able to raise funds for the things that are highest on the priority list there will be a big goal for 2020, and to continue to keep that momentum up. I mean, it was pretty interesting when we first started off to do this plan. Folks said, you're never going to get everyone to come together. You're never going to get the funding to be able to do it. The funding, I wouldn't say it came easily, but it came quickly, and people were excited about it. And then we had over about 500 people participate in the process, and people said, okay, well, now you've got a plan, and it's going to sit on the shelf. But people have actively been participating in it month after month and moving things forward. So it's been exciting, and I think 2020 will just be more opportunity to build on those. And so maybe we'll move from 22% complete on this plan to 50% complete. And, well, and I think there's a lot of exciting things that are coming closer and closer to fruition.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.